mood is the following. A situation arises that you feel to be an impediment to some goal you are trying to attain. Let's say you have to go to the DMV in the morning. This involves skipping breakfast. You think to yourself, I'm going to be starving. I don't even have time to stop at Starbucks for a latte. This negative thought has activated a light stress response in your body. As your cortisol levels rise slightly, you are more likely to interpret the next few events as being stressful. You get outside, and the sun is hidden by a blanket of clouds. Ugh, this weather. I need to move to California. More stress response. By now, you are stressed enough that your attention span has diminished, and a song on the radio that you normally would enjoy isn't bringing the same lift. You switch back and forth endlessly between radio stations in a futile attempt to find something worth listening to. Then you get stuck behind a bus. I'm going to get to the DMV late now. I'll be in line forever, and then I won't have time to do XYZ for the rest of the day. By the time you find yourself surrounded by other bored-out-of-their-mind patrons at the DMV, your smartphone has lost its fascination, as you frantically switch back and forth between Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook in search of anything to take your mind off the drudgery. Hey, didn't I get here before that person? Why was his number called first? Look at his stupid face. I could just punch him. These negative reactions to events are nothing more than bad habits. By breaking the negativity habit and replacing your old neuronal patterns with more positive ones, a situation that you once thought was a case of doom and gloom simply doesn't have the same emotional connotation as before. We are going to begin the positivity challenge, or what Emmett Fox, the original mastermind of this endeavor, called the 7-day mental diet. The rules. You need to have one unbroken week of positivity in order to complete the challenge. That doesn't mean that negativity won't occur. Of course it will. The key here is that you can't dwell on your negativity. You can't let the negative thoughts that come into your mind proliferate. You have to let them go or transform them into positive ones immediately. If you catch yourself trapped in a negative train of thought lasting for more than 1 minute, you have to restart the challenge all over again on day one. It would be a Herculean feat indeed to complete all 7 days without ever having to restart. Those that claim to do so usually aren't sufficiently aware of their thoughts to notice the subtle negativity that occurs. Or they might forget they're doing the challenge for hours at a time. What you need here is constant vigilance. You are likely to find that negativity comes at you like a rushing avalanche. When will this meeting end? You ask yourself. Doesn't he understand how boring he is? Is that another gray hair? My head will be white by the end of the year. All of these negative thoughts must be transformed into thoughts that are constructive. In addition to the growing positivity, your ability to watch your mind continuously will improve by leaps and bounds. Most of us are simply carried away by whatever thoughts and moods arise. This is a practice of distancing yourself from your own thoughts. You will learn more about your mind in this week than you will have in the previous decade. It took me numerous attempts to complete the positivity challenge. Most of the time, I never made it through the first day. Hell, probably not even more than a few hours. Once, I made it 6.5 days before I succumbed to negativity. But I persisted. So should you. After completing the challenge, you will notice a visceral difference in the way your body feels. You will be more relaxed, and habitual negative thought patterns will be replaced by more positive ones. When speaking to other people, you will notice how negative they are. You will hear someone say, "The world today, man, it's so awful." But instead of nodding in agreement, you will ask, "Is the sun still shining? Is there a couple out there enjoying a great first date? Does music still make you want to dance?" Tips. For the next week, the positivity challenge has to be the most important thing in your life. Your goal is a remarkable change in your habitual thought patterns. This isn't something to be taken lightly. It's not going to work if you only remember to do it from time to time. Go about your daily routine, but let the weight of these other concerns fade into the background. It's only 7 days. Your life won't go to shambles. To be constantly aware of your thoughts, and to actively change them whenever they veer to the dark side, is strenuous. You are fighting against habits that have been ingrained in you for as many years as you have been alive. Do not underestimate the fortitude that is necessary. Emmett Fox said that fasting for 7 days would be child's play compared to the difficulty of completing this challenge. He was exaggerating, but not by much. It is not that you will suffer while doing the challenge. After all, you will be remaining in a state of positivity. It is that it takes extreme mental discipline not to fall off the wagon. I found it helpful to have constant reminders to be positive. I bought a bracelet that had the word positive written on it. As I walked down the street or drove in my car, I would repeat the word positive over and over as if it was my mantra. The first few days are the most difficult, as the stream of negative thoughts will be at its most powerful. Once you have dammed the flow, you will find yourself beginning to automatically reinterpret potentially negative events as positive ones. The last few days will be easier, or so you think. But by some cruel fate, just when you think you are settled in, some unexpected drama will try to kick you to the curb. Here is where you must stay true to your goal, or risk starting all over again. If completing this challenge isn't something that interests you, you can go to a therapist, shell out thousands of dollars so that some complete stranger can analyze your thoughts, point out your negative and irrational beliefs, and change them into positive and rational ones. This is called cognitive behavioral therapy, and it is very effective in treating everything from anxiety, what if this pain in my stomach means I have liver cancer, to depression, I'll never amount to anything, what's the point of getting out of bed, to insomnia, if I don't fall asleep right now, I'll be tired and miserable tomorrow, and even to procrastination. I don't want to do work right now. I'm too tired and it's boring. I'll do it later. Or you can spend 1 week on the challenge I am proposing and make major headway on these problems, and perhaps even eliminate them in one fell swoop. Calm concentration. Do you suffer from obsessive-compulsive delusion disorder, OCDD? Never heard of it? That's because OCDD is a term that is not found in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. If it were, nearly every single person on Earth would suffer from it. The term was coined by B. Allen Wallace, a highly advanced meditator who worked as the Dalai Lama's interpreter before returning to California to get his PhD at Stanford. Let's see if you meet the diagnostic criteria. Are you able to stay mentally quiet while still alert and awake when you wish to? That is, can you get your mind to stop talking, to stop thinking obsessively about any subject at any time, and just remain in a calm quiescence at your voluntary control? Or is it the case that as soon as you wake up in the morning, your mind is already blabbering to you, and stays blabbering to you all day long until you go to sleep? If so, then you may suffer from obsessive thoughts. You have a compulsive relationship with your thoughts when you get caught up in your ruminations. You start thinking about a topic, say how your ex screwed you over, and you are carried away down that river of thoughts like a Class 5 rapid. You are not in control. Your thoughts are in control of you. The delusional part comes in when you believe that your thoughts are an accurate portrayal of what is going on in the universe. As the saying goes, I've known a lot of troubles in my life, most of which never happened. Every one of us suffers from OCDD, and 99% of us never realize that we don't have to. Through mind training, we can cure ourselves of this ubiquitous malady. We can have the freedom to think about what we want to think about when we want to think about it, and to stay quiet and present when we don't. B. Allen Wallace says, if you were able to focus your attention at will, you could actually choose the universe you inhabit. What he means is that in any situation, there are thousands of different things you could be focusing on. From the tactile feelings of your feet on the floor, the sounds going on around you, to the negative or positive thoughts regarding your boss's management style. The world as it appears to us is determined by what we focus on. And most people get caught up in whatever current of thoughts and sensations they happen to be experiencing without ever realizing they could be in direct control of their attention, like the commander of a ship. It is only when we have to do something boring, like homework or taxes, that we become aware of our inability to concentrate. To remedy their lack of focus, people may drink a few cups of coffee or take stimulant medication. I've been there. After being diagnosed with ADHD, I took those drugs for years. And they work remarkably well. But it's just a band-aid. And as soon as the drug wears off, there are side effects. None of my doctors ever told me that the ability to pay attention could be improved through mental exercises. The good news is that mind training offers not just a band-aid, but a potential cure for the wandering mind. Your attention span can be trained like a muscle, and the benefits of your newfound powers of concentration will be enormous. Being able to focus makes everything better and easier to learn. You can pick up new skills faster, your sex life will improve, and entering into a state of high concentration is in itself inherently pleasurable. Psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi is the leader of research in what he calls flow states. In a flow state, a person is completely immersed in the activity that he is doing, channeling his emotions positively into the task at hand. There is a lack of reflective self-consciousness, as the person is totally absorbed and focused. If you have ever played a sport and been in the proverbial zone, you know what this is like. If you have ever played an instrument or painted a picture and been so caught up in the moment that you have lost a sense of anything existing other than your performance, then you know what this is like. There is no boredom, anxiety, or depression in a flow state. Instead, a flow state is marked by a feeling of joy or even rapture in the activity. My time with the Amazonian tribes taught me that this kind of mindfulness was an evolutionary adaptation. Once, while trekking through the jungle, I was lost in my own thoughts, when a tribe member told me to watch my step and pointed to the ground. "Snake, very, very danger, poison, like cobra," he said. I had nearly stepped on it. But my native companions were always in the here and now, listening to every little jungle sound, or in this case, on the lookout for any little sliver. To be mindful in the Amazon jungle is literally a matter of life and death. Famed meditation teacher Shinzen Young had a similar experience meeting Amazonian and American Indians who have kept their culture intact. "These Indians have the same eyes as advanced meditators," he writes. "Their lifestyle puts them into a meditative state. Unfortunately, ours does not. If we want to be happy and calm, we need to return to the natural flow state of our hunter-gatherer ancestors. We can try to mimic their lifestyle as best we can, but we'll never completely get there. We need additional tools. Our ancestors would spend nights sitting by the fire, relaxing and watching the flames flicker. This was the first proto-meditation. Then they developed rhythmic dances and songs that took their baseline states of flow into deep states of ecstasy. You could do that too, but your roommates might think it's a bit weird that you spend your free time hopping around in a circle and wearing a feathered headdress. So I recommend meditation. With a consistent daily meditation practice of 30 minutes to an hour a day, changes in your baseline state of focus will be noticeable in a matter of weeks. Even more rigorous practice will prove exponentially more beneficial. A week-long retreat, fully absorbed in meditation from morning to night, can be a life-changing event. How to meditate. Drukpa Khunli is known as the divine madman of Bhutan. A famous poet and master of meditation from the 15th century, he used shock methods to awaken the clergy out of their prudish and restrictive behavior. Upon meeting the legendary Tibetan monk Tsongkhapa, he was given a scarf as a ceremonial blessing. Drukpa proceeded to tie the scarf around his penis and wave it about in a rotating fashion. A precocious child, Drukpa joined a monastery as a young man and spent a few years there before disrobing to wander the country as a mendicant. Walking into a new town, he would say things like, "Listen to me, all you people. I am Drukpa Khunli of Ralung, and I have come here today without prejudice to help you all. Where can I find the best booze and the most beautiful women? Tell me." He would then visit the local watering hole, get drunk, tell stories, sing songs, and deflower a few virgins, all ostensibly for the sake of their enlightenment. His penis is still known today in Bhutan as the Thunderbolt of Flaming Wisdom. Drukpa Khunli, Poem About Happiness. I am happy that I am a free yogi, so I grow more and more into my inner happiness. I can have sex with many women, because I help them to go the path of enlightenment. Outwardly, I'm a fool, and inwardly, I live with a clear spiritual system. Outwardly, I enjoy wine, women, and song, and inwardly, I work for the benefit of all beings. Outwardly, I live for my pleasure, and inwardly, I do everything in the right moment. Outwardly, I am a ragged beggar, and inwardly, a blissful Buddha. He also wrote, "I practice the path of self-discipline. I meditate every day. And so must you." Setting up a practice. It is best to set up a formal meditation practice that becomes part of your daily routine. A meditation session in the morning will give you a great start to the day. Make sure you are awake, though. Do a few stretches, get some sunlight, take a shower or just splash your face with cold water. You don't want to still be drowsy while you meditate. Another session in the evening will help you relax and wind down. For busy people, I recommend that each of these sessions be 30 minutes long, or an hour of total meditation a day. Set a timer that will peacefully alert you when your time is up. Constant glances of the clock will interrupt your stream of mindfulness. Skeptic: "Are you nuts? I don't have an hour a day. When will I watch my television shows and read fake news articles? I can't possibly cut down on the 9 hours a day I spend looking at a phone, computer, or television screen." Answer: Meditation won't take up an hour a day. It will make you more fully present for the other 23. And because you won't be distracted during every other waking hour, you'll find that you will be able to get everything you need to get done more quickly, more efficiently, and in the end, you'll end up with more free time. But I guess if someone has a gun to your head, and that's really the only legitimate excuse not to meditate for at least 30 minutes a day, then do whatever you can, whether it's 5 minutes or 10. Now, there is a caveat for beginners. When you first start, you might find it difficult to meditate for 30 minutes straight. Your mind is just too crazy, and your body aches too much from the posture you're holding. In that case, start with 10 minutes per sit, and increase it by a few minutes each day until you reach 30. If you have time, sit for even longer. After a year, it shouldn't be a problem to sit for an hour straight. If you can meditate 3, 4, or even 10 hours a day, don't hold back. The rule for how often you should meditate is this: as much as possible. Schedule these meditation sessions in your daily planner and stick to it. Eventually, it will become a pleasant habit to look forward to. No one's ever said, "You know what? I wasted too much time meditating." Pick a place to meditate that is free of distractions. You should not be bothered by the chatter of conversation or other loud noises. You want it to be as quiet as possible. For those that live in the city and are assaulted by a constant stream of honking horns and police sirens, a pair of earplugs is essential. If you like to meditate with your eyes open, then the space in front of you should be clear of any visuals that will catch your eye. A blank wall is fantastic. Posture. You don't have to assume the full lotus position to meditate. In fact, there are only two rules that you should keep in mind when finding a posture for meditation. 1. Keep your spine straight, all the way up through your neck. There is a physiological reason for this. With a straight spine, you are more attentive. With slumped shoulders, your body falls into a stupor. Your eyes can be closed or slightly open. Your gaze directed either straight in front of you or slightly downward. 2. Assume a position that will be comfortable for you to remain still in for the duration of your meditation session. You don't want body parts to start hurting or going numb. Nor should you be shuffling around all the time. You want to keep your full attention on the breath. If you want to sit in a chair, you can sit in a chair. That is perfectly fine. Personally, I like to place a zafu cushion on top of a yoga mat and sit on the edge of the cushion. Both my knees will touch the ground with one leg resting in front of the other. This is called Burmese style. If you can lie flat on your back without getting sleepy, that position is also acceptable. Westerners have trouble with any sitting position that involves keeping the back straight. We are so used to being slouches that our hip and back muscles will ache after only a few minutes. Well, tough it out. After a week, you will be able to hold your spine straight without any problem. People will comment on how your posture has improved. If you are sitting on a cushion, a common complaint is pain in the knees. Again, the advice here is to tough it out for a while. If you can sit Burmese style at first for only 5 minutes before the pain becomes too distracting, that's fine. The next time you meditate, try to hold it for 7 minutes. Eventually, you will be able to work your way up to an hour or even more. When I first saw Bhante Ji in the meditation hall, it was so early in the morning that the sun had yet to rise. I could only see his outline through the dim candlelight. He was meditating and sat so still and erect that it took me a while to realize that he wasn't a statue. Mindfulness and breathing meditation. Take a minute to settle into your posture. Get yourself comfortable, but keep your spine upright. Meditation involves a balancing act between vigilance and relaxation. Too much vigilance, and we will become tense, strained, and wear ourselves out. Too relaxed, and our minds will become dull or even fall asleep. Become aware of the sensations of your body, and notice what is going on there. Slowly bring your attention to the sensations of the breath going in and out of your body. Meditators debate as to just where in the body we should focus on the breath. Some say at the tip of the nose, some say at the abdomen, others just the entire feeling of the breath. I don't think it matters. Just do what comes naturally to you. As your breath goes in and out, keep your focus on the sensations caused by the breath cycle. Just feel the movement of the breath. Note when it reaches the apex of the inhalation, the short time when your breath is full, and that brief pause after exhalation when you no longer have any air in your lungs. Keep your mind on the breath throughout the entire duration of its cycle. If you notice you are having problems becoming too tense or too dull, then balance yourself out by arousing your awareness on the in-breath, and then relaxing deeply on the out-breath. Don't pull your breath. This is trickier than it seems. Don't force yourself to breathe slowly or more deeply so that the physical sensations become more palpable. Just let your breath be. Just watch it. However you are breathing is fine. Inevitably, your mind will wander from the breath. As a beginner, this will happen quickly. You will start thinking about your day, things you still have planned to do, a conversation you just had with someone, or thoughts about your meditation. Am I doing it right? I think I'm doing okay. Just focus on the breath. Whenever you catch yourself caught up in distracting thoughts, just gently return to the breath. Don't be frustrated that you were thinking. That will make it worse. Just relax and go back to the inhalations and exhalations of your breath. If you are having difficulty concentrating, then experiment with counting the breaths. Watch the breath come in fully, noting the quick pause before the exhalation begins. After the air flows out and you reach the end of the exhalation, silently note 1. After another cycle of inhalation and exhalation, note 2. Keep counting all the way up to 10, and then start the counting over again at 1. If at any point you have forgotten what number you are on, just start over at 1. Once you feel that your concentration has become strong again, stop counting and return to just the feeling of the breath. Progress. A common analogy is to describe the beginner's mind as that of a waterfall. As you try to focus on your breath, you are distracted by a flood of thoughts, images, sensations, sounds, and who knows what else. This is the monkey mind. You will not be able to focus on your breath for more than a few moments before it getting lost in some daydream. Minutes will pass before you realize, "Oh yeah, I was supposed to be meditating." This is normal. If you could focus completely on your breath without distraction from the very beginning, there would be no need to do this type of meditation. The more you practice, the longer you will be able to sustain your focus on the breath, and the less you will be bothered by distractions. Think of it as a seesaw. On one end are all the things that distract you from the breath, such as thoughts, images, sensations, etc. On the other side of the seesaw is your attention to the breath. When you are just starting out, all the distractions will dominate, and you will have only intermittent attention to your breath. You will watch your breath for a few counts of 10, and then get lost. Eventually, you will be able to stay with the breath longer and longer. The times when you are completely lost in a daydream will diminish. The distractions will still be there in the background, but they won't be strong enough to completely pull you away from the breath. At this point, the seesaw is about level. The goal now is to increase the vividness and exclusivity of your attention to the breath. By vividness, I mean the degree to which you fully perceive the breath. Noticing each moment of the breath as it comes in, pauses, and then goes out, not wavering from the breath at all during its duration. Exclusivity means that the background distractions become more and more subtle, and eventually disappear altogether for periods of time. There are now moments when you are singularly focused on the breath without any other sensations interfering. Mastery of this type of meditation comes when you can maintain single-focused attention on the breath effortlessly, without distraction, and consistently when you meditate. When this happens, great joy, bliss, and tranquility will arise. Outside of your meditation sessions, you will feel light, relaxed, and have exceptional mental balance. Metta. A human being is part of the whole, called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. Nobody is able to achieve this completely, but the striving for such achievement is in itself a part of the liberation and a foundation for inner security. Albert Einstein. While loving our families comes naturally, and developing love for our friends is relatively easy, our feelings toward strangers we have never met are hardly ones of love. Might we feel curiosity about them? Sure. Might we extend overtures of friendship? Possibly. But do we feel a deep, profound love and compassion towards them? If you are like most people, the answer is no. Depending on the situation, there might be a bit of wariness regarding the stranger's intentions. Evolution has superb reasons for wiring us this way. The majority of South American and Central American natives did not die from the swords and bullets of the Spanish invaders, but from the smallpox they carried. Foreigners grow up in different environments and are exposed to different viruses and bacteria to which people never exposed to these germs have no immunity. If you came across a stranger in ancient times, that person might be carrying a disease that could wipe out your whole tribe. Or they might want to seize our women or our land. In ancient times, it was better to have a healthy skepticism towards strangers until you were reasonably sure that they meant you no harm. But today's world is different. In first world countries, you can feel safe walking down most streets and do not have to worry that someone is going to harm you. The safety of the modern world makes it possible to spread our net of compassion to include not just close family and friends, but the entire world, just as Einstein advised. Everybody wants to be happy. Engage in an exercise with me. I want you to vividly imagine someone you love. It could be a family member, a spouse, whomever, as long as you love them. Picture their face, or if they happen to be in the room with you right now, take a good look at them. As you are visualizing or looking at their face, use your capacity for empathy to imagine what it is like to be them. They are probably thinking about things they want to happen to them, things they hope to avoid. They are self-conscious about how others perceive them. They want to make a good impression. They want to be successful. They want things to go well for them. They want to be happy. In this regard, they are just like you. If you found it easy to empathize with a loved one, now picture someone you don't know very well, someone you may have passed on the street. It could be someone sitting next to you on the plane. It doesn't matter who. Just as long as you can visualize their face and your feelings are rather neutral towards them. Use empathy to imagine what it is like to be them. They too are thinking of things they want to happen to them, things they hope to avoid. They want people to like them. They want to be successful. They want to be happy. Nobody wakes up and says, "I hope I contract syphilis today." People want to enjoy life. People want to be happy, but they are confused as to how to go about it. It is hard to remember that everyone you meet is struggling with hopes, dreams, desires for love and affection, just as you are. We need to remind ourselves that everyone wants to be happy, everyone wants things to go well for them, and everyone wants to avoid suffering. Metta Meditation. Metta, spelled M-E-T-T-A, is a Pali word that is often translated to mean loving friendliness or benevolent goodwill. In metta meditation, we first cultivate this feeling of metta towards ourselves, then our family members, and then gradually outwards until this feeling of metta encompasses the entire universe. Begin your practice by doing some mindfulness of breathing. When you feel that you have settled in and your mind has calmed down, silently repeat the following phrase. May I be well, happy, and peaceful. May I be well, happy, and peaceful. May I be well, happy, and peaceful. Keep on repeating this phrase, slowly and meaningfully. As you do so, visualize yourself being well, happy, and peaceful. Feel this happiness in your body. Try to enhance that feeling. The more you do it, the easier it will be to generate this feeling on command. Sometimes you won't be able to. Sometimes, despite repeating the phrases over and over, the feeling of loving friendliness won't arise. That's okay. The more concentrated and calm your mind is, the easier it will become. The more you practice, the better you will get. Repeat. May I be well, happy and peaceful for at least 5 minutes. Then move on to the following phrases. The instructions are the same as before, visualizing as best you can the other people being well, happy, and peaceful. Really try and feel their happiness. Repeat each phrase for 5 minutes and then move on to the next phrase. May my family be well, happy, and peaceful. May my friends be well, happy, and peaceful. May all indifferent persons be well, happy, and peaceful. May all unfriendly persons be well, happy, and peaceful. May all beings be well, happy, and peaceful. A more advanced version of metta meditation involves imagining a glowing white orb of light at the center of your chest. The instructions begin the same as before. Start your meditation as you normally would, with mindfulness of breathing. Once your mind is calmed down and you feel able to concentrate, begin to visualize an orb of white light in the very center of your chest. This light represents benevolent goodwill. With each in-breath, imagine the white light growing and expanding. Do this for a few minutes. When you can clearly visualize this orb, then on each out-breath, imagine rays of this radiant white light infusing your entire body. As you do this, generate the feeling that this white light is filling you with loving friendliness. On every out-breath, visualize the rays of light leaving the orb in the center of your chest and infusing your head and limbs all the way down to your fingertips. Once you have fully infused your body with benevolent goodwill, both in the visualization of white light throughout your body and in the positive feeling of loving friendliness, then begin to imagine a loved one. Take the benevolent goodwill from that orb of white light at your chest and send those rays outwards until they hit the chest of the loved one you are thinking about. Continue for a few minutes, sending that ray of light into the loved one until their entire body is infused and you feel an abundant goodwill towards that person. Now expand the direction of the white light by sending it out to everyone in the near vicinity. Repeat the previous steps as you imagine the blanket of white light shooting out from the center of your chest in all directions and infusing the bodies of everyone in your community. Do this for a few minutes, and then expand the rays of light from your chest even further outwards. Imagine this bright white light covering the entire earth and all beings. Vividly imagine people on every continent becoming infused with this light. At this point, you should feel benevolent goodwill towards the whole earth. Stay here for a few minutes before continuing with one final step. Take the white light that is now covering the entire planet and expand it outwards until it flows through every nook and cranny of the universe. Your benevolent goodwill now engulfs the universe at large. If your concentration is strong and you have completed this meditation with focus, you should now viscerally feel this loving friendliness for the universe in your body. Benefits of metta. Metta meditation may seem similar to prayer, but it is not. Prayer involves the belief that your thoughts are going to reach some transcendent being who will answer them and make your wishes come true. In metta meditation, one may wish for others to be happy, but there is no force that will make them come true. What will happen is that the act of saying these phrases will bring about changes in your own mind. Numerous studies have cataloged the benefits of practicing metta meditation. They include an increased sense of well-being with greater experiences of positive emotions and life satisfaction. Metta meditation makes people more likely to be helpful, increases their empathy and compassion, and decreases their bias towards others. It makes them more likely to increase their number of social connections. It reduces stress, mental illness, and even signs of aging. These studies show that the benefits of metta improve over time as people get better at the meditation. And while these studies generally had participants meditating only about 15 minutes per day, metta has the advantage of being easily practiced far more often than that. You can practice metta not only on the cushion, but as you go about your daily life. When you're cooking breakfast, repeat the phrases, "May I be well and happy. May my family be well and happy." When you are walking down the street, wish that every person you pass be well and happy. Metta also helps with concentration. If you are doing mindfulness of breathing and can't seem to focus on your breath, it can be helpful to switch over to metta practice until your mind calms down. Metta relaxes you, which pacifies the monkey mind, and the very act of repeating the phrases is an act of concentration itself. When you mix metta with very strong concentration, the results become quite profound, and with a little practice, one can radiate a sense of loving friendliness for all the world. Einstein told us that we need to expand our compassion towards all of nature and its beauty. With metta meditation, we have a method by which we can turn this thought into reality. Jhana, the natural ecstasy. What is your idea of ultimate pleasure? Perhaps it is being bathed in candlelight, the taste of perfectly aged wine on your lips, while being massaged with fragrant oils and worked into a fit of passion in preparation for making love to the girl of your dreams, your partner's better-looking best friend. Perhaps you think it takes more chemical assistance, like the rush of heroin coursing through your veins. Or maybe it's the standard line everybody falls back on, the moment of your child's birth. What if I were to tell you that a pleasure exists out there that is more enjoyable than any of these things, without the side effects of jealous partners, overdosing, or having to change diapers? That this pleasure is completely free, could be had at any moment in which you are able to simply sit quietly, and has no negative side effects. You probably wouldn't believe me, but it's true, my friends. It's true. On my first long meditation retreat, I settled into some good concentration by the fourth day. Using a combination of metta and mindfulness of breathing, my focus was stronger than it had ever been before. Distractions such as the sounds of people shuffling next to me ceased, and my mind remained focused exclusively on the sensations of my breath. Joy began to creep up, and I decided to enhance it with some metta. May all beings be well and happy. With my strong concentration, the metta had a cumulative effect and increased the joy I felt in my body. I continued, "May all beings be well and happy. May all beings be well and happy." The joy became even stronger and was palpable. I then switched from mindfulness of breathing to focusing directly on the joy. When I did this, the joy spread throughout my body, infusing my torso and limbs with a powerful, pleasant energy. When I tried to continue my metta practice, something odd happened. Although my eyes were closed, everything seemed to get brighter in this golden light. Also, I no longer felt as if I was intentionally uttering the metta mantra. Instead, the words and joy had control over me. The well-wishing for others' happiness had taken on a life of its own, and I was just along for the ride. I was completely immersed in this feeling of joy as it grew in intensity. The volume of the pleasantness and compassion for others became overwhelming, as if I might geek out right there in the meditation hall. After the meditation session was over, we all headed into the tea room to relax. As I sat down, I noticed a girl sitting across from me. She was looking at me and laughing. I had such a blissful aura, I must have seemed totally high. Since it was a silent retreat and no talking allowed, I wrote a note to a friend who was on the retreat with me and passed it to her. It read, "I feel as if someone slipped me a molly." The bliss and joy would tone down a bit, but some form of it would remain with me for the last few days of the retreat. What had just happened to me? I had simply sat down on a cushion, totally sober, watching my breath and wishing happiness for all, and had entered a state of pleasure more intense than sex or drugs and without any of the adverse side effects. This was incredible. Was this the state of meditation known as jhana I had heard so much about? Getting to jhana. To achieve jhana, one's concentration skills have to be very powerful. It generally takes many months of serious practice of at least 1 to 2 hours per day as a good base, followed by an intense retreat to make it possible. However, there are no rules stipulating how fast one can make progress in meditation, and the variety here is enormous. Once you have attained this level of concentration, further practice will help you to maintain it, and the bliss of jhana can be accessed at will. As meditation teacher Daniel Ingram puts it, when you have such strong concentration, you can either go home from work and crack open a beer, or sit on your meditation cushion and bathe yourself in as much bliss as you can possibly handle. The first step is getting to access concentration, which I will describe in a little more detail now. With increased practice of mindfulness of breathing, you will become more focused on the breath, and distractions will fall by the wayside. As you do this, you will reach a point that the Buddhist monk Ajahn Brahm called the beautiful breath. Following the breath becomes delightful, and the discontent that is the source of mind wandering evaporates. Distractions such as sounds, sensations, even thoughts will hardly register in conscious experience, if at all. You are fully and exclusively with the breath. This is access concentration. When you can remain here for 10 to 15 minutes, you are ready to go for jhana. Switch your object of meditation from the sensations of the breath to a feeling of joy that should now be palpable within your body. Focus on the pleasurable feeling, and as you focus on it, that pleasurable feeling should intensify. At first, your mind might want to go back to the breath, or you might focus on the pleasure and it won't expand. If that happens, just rest back and access concentration for a moment, and then try again. When you are able to maintain focus on the pleasurable sensations and notice their expansion throughout your body, you are getting close to jhana. This may not happen in a linear way. The pleasurable sensations may grow a bit, stop, grow a bit more, etc. The key here is not to try and force it. You cannot will jhana to happen. It is not something that you do, but something that happens to you. All you can do is focus on the pleasure and let it happen. Eventually, the pleasure will expand to the point where it takes up your entire conscious experience. You will feel as if you have sunk into and completely immersed in this pleasure. It is obviously an altered state of consciousness. There is rapture, ecstasy, supreme delight. This is the first jhana. But we can get even happier. Once you have mastered the first jhana, which can take days or weeks or even longer, and can hold on to it for at least 15 minutes, then you are ready to move on to the second jhana. The first jhana isn't completely satisfying due to that geeking out quality I mentioned on my meditation retreat. There is a certain unstable feeling to the first jhana. In the second jhana, our attention moves away from these physical sensations of pleasure and focuses more on mental happiness and joy. The mind becomes intensely focused on these positive emotional qualities, and the instability of the first jhana is gone. The rapturous delight of physical sensations is still there, however, and eventually, believe it or not, these get tiresome. When this happens, you are ready to move on to the third jhana. The third jhana is a much more serene state than the previous two. It is a state of deep, happy contentment that occurs when we let go of the energetic sensations that abound in the first two jhanas. Here, one notices the difference between contentment and joy. Joy is that jumping up and down quality, while contentment is more like an ah. The third jhana is the latter, only far more still. and far more powerful than anything you have experienced in normal life. Amazingly, there comes a point where all feelings of happiness, bliss, and even contentment get old. In the third jhana, there is a strong sense of stillness. In the fourth jhana, this stillness turns into equanimity, a state of astonishing imperturbability and peace. No happiness, no suffering, just a deep peacefulness that is all-pervading. There are more jhanas to go, but they are not about happiness, but about entering the formless realms. States of mind completely off the map from anything you could experience in normal reality. It is best at this point to get a meditation teacher to guide you through them. The science of the jhanas. Scientists have studied the jhanas under experimental conditions. Wanting to know why meditators reported such extreme joy while in the jhanas, they hooked up a meditation master and had him cycle through the jhanas. They found that in the first few jhanas, the meditator activated the dopamine-opioid reward system in the brain. And although these experiences were subjectively reported by the meditator as being more joyful than multiple orgasms, the scientists did not find that the amount of activation in the dopamine-opioid system to be extreme. Instead, they explained that the subjective experience of such joy was in the signal-to-noise ratio. In jhanic meditation, the meditator reports having this internal dialogue turned down. The mind becomes quiet. Scientists tested this by looking at the Broca and Wernicke's area of the brain. These two parts of the brain are associated with language, and they were found to be significantly less active during jhana. Meditators also report less awareness of the external world. So the scientists sought to see if areas of the brain that process auditory and visual stimuli were less active. Once again, the scientists found this to be true. Because the meditator in jhana is less aware of external stimuli, as well as having his internal dialogue pacified, the pleasurable feeling produced by activation of the dopamine-opioid system becomes the sole focus of attention. Without anything internal or external to distract the meditator away from the pleasurable feeling, that feeling appears more intense than drugs or sex. Extreme activation of the dopamine-opioid system has its downside, what every drug user calls a crash. This is due to a depletion of the neurotransmitters that caused the feeling of happiness in the first place. The brain has used them all up and is now deficient. Because the dopamine-opioid system in jhanic meditation is only moderately active in comparison to drugs, there is no reported crash, although the joyful feeling does vanish when the meditator cycles to the higher jhanas. Could this be due to mild dopamine depletion from the pleasurable lower jhanas? The scientists did find that activation of the dopamine-opioid system was less than in a resting state during the fifth jhana. The meditator has another advantage besides not crashing over the drug user. Tolerance. The drug user will quickly build up tolerance to his drug of choice, and ever greater amounts of the drug will be needed to reach the level of that initial high. Eventually, as in addiction, the drug may not produce any pleasure at all, but the addict will still crave it. The jhanic meditator does not build up a tolerance to jhana. In fact, getting into jhana becomes progressively deeper and easier to do with practice. What is real jhana? Most of the people listening to this book won't know about the great jhana controversy in the Buddhist community. But if you delve more deeply into books on jhana or go on jhana retreats, you may hear different ideas of what constitutes real jhana and what is just a facsimile. For those interested in investigating the jhanas further, and I hope all of you feel this way, it's worth mentioning a bit about the controversy here. The confusion originates in the ancient literature, which gives varying descriptions of jhana. In the original suttas, the speeches said to be given by the Buddha, jhana is more easily attainable. In the later commentaries of the suttas, written by monks hundreds of years later, Jhana has become something far grander. Jhanas are described as states that can only be reached by the most serious meditators, usually monks on very long retreats, and involves such fantastic feats as being able to sit in jhana for 24 hours straight. They are entered not from focusing on a pleasurable sensation, but what is called a nimitta, a spark of light that develops while you are in access concentration. In these jhanas, the five physical senses and thought completely drop away. Someone could yell in your ear, even pick you up and drop you back down, and you would be so absorbed in your jhana that you would never know it. While the jhanas of the commentaries are far deeper, more profound, and even more blissful, the sutta jhanas that I have explained in this chapter are extremely nice in their own right. So much so that a sexual embrace, a nose full of cocaine, and watching your child's first steps seem like suffering by comparison. 5. The nature of reality. The end of stress. If you've listened this far into the book and applied the tips to your life, you are probably a pretty chill person by now. But your happiness levels are still unstable because they depend on outward conditions. Are you healthy? Are you employed? How is your romantic life going? Because the factors of your life are constantly fluctuating, so is your happiness. Wouldn't it be great if you could be happy and stress-free no matter what? Amazingly, there is a way. A path developed long ago by a man we call the Buddha and refined over the last 2,500 years by Buddhist monks. Those funny-looking bald guys in orange robes actually figured out how to permanently end stress and slipped us the secret. The problem was, the message was wrapped up in too much religious dogma, too many superstitions, and rules of celibacy so strict that most of us would refuse to listen. Consider this pearl of wisdom. It would be better that your penis be stuck into the mouth of a black viper than into a woman's vagina. The Buddha. I bet you never read that quote when you cracked open your fortune cookie. Even in Asian cultures, where many people are Buddhists, they are usually only nominally so. They may go to a few temples, perform a few rituals, maybe even have a little meditation practice, but they never go all in on the business of actually ending stress. The path to the end of stress needs to be stripped of this cumbersome religious baggage, purged of its dubious metaphysical theories regarding karma and reincarnation, and translated into the language of contemporary science. That is what I present to you. Here is what I call evolution and the Four Noble Truths. 1. There is stress. Stress here is defined as any sort of mental tension, from the slightest feeling of unease to all the way to depression and panic. It's any time we are not totally freaking chill. 2. Stress is caused by desire. When we normally think of the word desire, we tend to imagine intense desires, like the desire to own a speedboat or pure sexual lust. Desire here is much more subtle. It is any sort of judgment about what is going on and wishing it were different, such as getting impatient while sitting at a red light. What will our impatience accomplish at that moment? If we look closely, we can see that these judgments occur during almost every single moment of conscious experience. It's built into the way we process reality. The first two noble truths can be summed up as, there is tension between what one wants and what is. 3. Stress can be eliminated by turning off the mechanisms in the brain that create desire. The earliest organisms evolved mechanisms in their nervous system to approach food and mates, and to avoid being eaten. These early approach avoidance mechanisms were the genesis of the more complicated system we have in our brains today. Still, all of the complex wants and emotions that we experience in everyday life can be simplified into two activities. Gravitating toward things that are good for the gene's ability to survive and replicate, and avoiding things that are harmful. If we were able to turn off the mechanism in our brain that causes us to perpetually judge our experience on the basis of approach or avoid,